Vaughn picked it up immediately. How many people have seen this? The comms officer on duty, my assistant, me, and now you. Only four. It was two people too many. Maybe three. Still, it might not find its way onto the nets, depending on how well the EMC controlled information in its house. It was the nature of bad news to spread, and once it was out forever. She had to assume that she didn't have much time before it did. One more chance to try being the person that the situation called for, instead of just herself. If she were the person who should be here, if she were the leader that the Union and the system and humanity needed, what would she say now? How would she say it? Wake Laughlin up, and get Admiral Hu on the horn. We're going to need a talk. Palace Station, Trejo had called it. Not Palace Tycho Complex. One of the strange things about Laconian language was the decades of linguistic drift. No one had called it Palace Station since before Sandrani had been in charge of the Union. He'd overseen the update of Palace's refineries and the semi-permanent installation of Tycho Station as the primary shipyard of the metals and ceramics, lace and nano-laminates produced there. It had been more efficient than leaving Tycho independently on the float. There were generations of work that would need to be done, and putting everything in the same place made it all go faster. People's Home had been assembled there, and Independence. The void city assurance of peace was half together now, its vast carbon silicate ribs still bared to the vacuum. Thousands of families lived and worked there, and would for another few hours, unless Drummer capitulated. The loss of building capacity would set us back by decades, Admiral Hu said. Any chance we have of rebuilding and fortifying a navy relies on that station. This would cause a bottleneck that would radically change our projections. Drummer shifted in her chair. It wasn't the first time she'd listened to the message. Deploying the full force of the EMC and Union Combined Navy can't be accomplished in the time frame described here. Whose face was replaced by a schematic of the system. Each fleet marked with its time to engagement. They'd been keeping the ships scattered to deny the Tempest a single target-rich environment. Here was the trade-off for that. And furthermore, only 3/4 of our ships have completed resupply with the torpedo modifications based on our first engagement. Our strategic analysis is that a decision to sacrifice Palace Tycho Complex in order to fully prepare the combined fleet would degrade our long-term readiness, but increase our chances of making a decisive blow against the Tempest in the short term. Of course, any decision requires full coordination between the Union and the EMC. Whatever she chose, they would do the same. In the midst of the apocalypse, the military brass on Luna were still playing cover your ass. That seemed like the most optimistic thing about the whole report. They still thought that they might have careers worth losing when this was over. Drummer could remember living on Tycho Station. She could still walk through the corridors in her memory. The layout of the engineering decks, the way they had been before the refit. The smell of the habitation ring. The office she'd inherited from Fred Johnson after his death. He'd had a personal cabinet there with a few things. An old book, a bottle of brandy, the physical copies of some of his personal initiatives that had foundered after he'd gone. She'd been the head of Tycho Station for 3 years before she'd cleared that out, and she still remembered how it had felt when she had. Like a widow, finally selling off her dead husband's suits. When she looked at Palace Tycho Complex, she felt the same way again. She wanted a way to save it. She kept looking for the clever move that would put it out of the enemy's hands, only there wasn't one. It was already too late. She could hand it and any chance of freedom away, or she could see it destroyed. One or the other. And she had to choose. Vaughn, Madam President, we need to put out an emergency evacuation order for Palace Tycho. Everyone who doesn't have their own craft, put on Tycho and break it away from the complex. No one is to be left in the palace structures. And the highest possible burn for all ships and Tycho Station is recommended. She looked over at him. His face was grayish. His eyes were dead as a shark's. He didn't argue, though. He only braced, turned, and left the room to carry out her order. Even if he disagreed with her, he was probably glad he hadn't had to make the call. She would have been. She set her system to record, considered herself on the screen. Her eyes were sunken with exhaustion and despair, but not as badly as she thought they would be. Her skin had a waxy look in the bright light of her private office. She'd want to have the communications staff get her some powder and rouge before she made the public announcement. God, there would have to be a public announcement. But that was later. That was next. She keyed in the reply code, and the high security link to Luna showed ready. She coughed and looked into the camera. Admiral Hu, I have given the evacuation order to Palace Tycho, she said. Even if we can't save the station, we can make it harder for the Tempest to kill the population there, and seeing whether they feel the civilian targets are worth hunting down may also give us greater insight into the character and aims of the enemy. I advise the EMC forces to refrain from any premature engagement with the enemy at this time. It is my opinion that attempting to save Palace Station would have been an error, she said. It would be better to prepare the forces we have at our disposal for a full, coordinated, and unrestrained engagement under circumstances more nearly in our control and to our advantage, and with the modified torpedoes and munitions available to all ships. Whatever gives us the best chance in that battle is worth the sacrifice. She paused. She was thinking this all through as she said it. The implications of the choice she'd made, and the future of the war. "We only have one shot at this," she said. "There isn't room for half measures. We're going for the kill."
Chapter 32. Holden. The electric cart they rode on seemed almost as old as the station. The magnetic wheels gripped the ramp and kept them on track even as the spin gravity of the drum fell slowly away. If Medina Station had followed its intended path, it would have been well away from Earth by now, gone into the vast depths between the stars where spare carts were pretty hard to come by. The Mormons had built everything about the ship to last for generations, to grow and renew itself, to recycle with the least possible loss. Medina Station would outlive them all. Except that he was going to blow a hole in it. Amos rode shotgun, his hands splayed wide on his knees, his head freshly shaved. From his place in the back seat, Holden mostly saw the back of the big man's neck, white skin flecked with age spots, but still muscular and hard. He didn't need to see the amiable smile to know it was there and how little it meant. A massive conduit wrench clanked at Amos's feet. Katria drove with a studied boredom of someone who knew the consequences of drawing the attention of station security. Her hair was already in a tight bun, prepped for the null G of engineering. She tapped her palm against the side of the cart as if she were listening to music, so maybe she already had her earpiece in. Holden tried to lean back against the seat, but in the lower G it just scooted him forward. The bomb rested on the bench beside him like a fourth person. It wasn't big, a square box safety orange with scratches at the edges and corners, the marks of long use. He didn't know exactly what was inside it, only that Katria was certain it would blow the right kind of hole into the pressure tanks, and that the ruptured pressure tanks would blow the right part of the station apart. She also said that in its present form, it was both hard for security to detect and stable enough to play football with, if you didn't mind a square ball. Still, Holden didn't rest his elbow on it. They were nearly at the top of the ramp when a line of carts stopped them, all heading the same direction as they were and all stuck waiting. At the entrance to the transfer point, three Laconian Marines in power armor were talking to a dark-skinned woman in a green jumpsuit. "Checkpoint," Holden said. "Inconvenience?" Katria said. She sounded like it was an annoyance more than an immediate threat to all their lives and the safety of everyone in the underground who was counting on them. He really did admire the way she did that. The raid had come two shifts before, when Holden had been in his sleep cycle. Between the time he'd curled up in the bunk and put his head on the thin pillow, and when he'd opened his eyes again, a quarter of Saba's people had been snatched up, and a man named Overstreet was on all the screens in the station telling the rest of Medina about it. And the typhoon was already past its flip and burn, breaking now toward the other side of the Laconia gate. They weren't saying exactly when it was supposed to arrive, but their data placed it at around 10 days. And the news from Seoul looked grim, even correcting for the fact that it was all coming through the state-run news feed. The noose was drawing tight. And in order to have any chance of escaping it, they were about to at least risk the lives of, and most probably kill, a bunch of people who were on the engineering decks at the wrong time. "Holden, do you have to do that?" Katria asked.
"Do what?"
"Grunt."
"Was I grunting?"
"Cap does that when he's thinking about something he don't like,"
Amos said.
"He has a wide variety to choose from," Katria said.
From the way they talked, Holden could almost believe that they wouldn't kill each other, given the chance. Almost, but not enough that he was sorry to be there. Maybe Katria really didn't hold a grudge about the fight that Amos had started. And maybe Amos wasn't spoiling to start another one. Or maybe the bomb was the most stable thing in the cart.
"I'll think happy thoughts," Holden said.
"Butterflies. Rainbows."
"What the fuck is a butterfly?"
Katria said. The cart ahead of them shifted, and they followed. It took 15 minutes to get to the guards, and then a minute and a half to get past them. Their cover story, Holden and Amos were applying for on-station work permits since their ship was locked down, and Katria was taking them to an on-site test, never even came up. Katria drove the cart to its queue, strapped the bomb to her back, and led them into the engineering decks, moving from handhold to handhold with the unremarked grace of someone who'd spent a good portion of their life on the float. Amos followed, with a conduit wrench in his fist like a club. Once the drum was well behind them, Holden pulled the earpiece out of his pocket and turned on the contact microphone.
"It's clear," Clarissa said. "Can you confirm?"
"Yep,"
Alex replied, his voice slow in the way that meant he was concentrating.
"I'm moving my little pixies through now. Give me just a... All right, I'm through."
"Turning the recycler back on," Clarissa said.
Clarissa and her team were in the drum, tapped into the environmental controls through a back door that, if they were found out, Saba would never be able to use again. Alex was back in the underground's galley, flying the drones with his hand terminal and several layers of encryption. Naomi and Bobby were, he assumed, loitering outside the secure server room, ready to force their way in. It was strange hearing their voices as if they were with him. It made him feel like he was back on the Rocinante. The engineering decks of Medina were a lesson in the way ships learned and changed over time. If he squinted, he could still see the bones of the original, unmodified space, but years and mission drift had altered everything. Here, a section of floor had a slightly different color where a bulkhead had been taken out. There, a set of conduits had been rerouted with the three-point welding style that Martians favored. The pipes along the walls were labeled in half a dozen languages and safety regulation styles. History made physical. Even where the walls were had changed over the years. Added extra reinforcement from when the docks had been built, or taken away when the new generation reactors had been put in place. Katria led the way down a side corridor, moving from handhold to foothold to handhold. Amos followed close behind her, only crowding her a little, and she seemed not to notice, or at least not to care. Their little triumvirate. Katria to place the charge, Amos to keep an eye on her, and Holden to keep an eye on him. A young woman floated past them, coming the other way. She had an electrician's rig strapped to her arm, and her hair was the same texture Naomi's had been when they'd first met. She passed Katria, then Amos. When she and Holden landed at the same handhold, she smiled an apology and pushed quickly off. He wondered whether they were about to kill her. Seemed possible. He hated the thought. "Alex," Bobby said, "you're awfully quiet there, buddy. Everything all right?"
"Yeah, sorry. Just, there's a little lag. It's not bad, but it makes me paranoid. Last thing I want is one of these charges to go off in a vent someplace, take the whole group out."
"That would be bad," Bobby agreed. "Jim," Naomi said, "are you on yet?"
"We're here," he said softly.
"Past the checkpoint. Not at the pressure tank yet."
"There was a checkpoint?" Bobby said.
Amos's voice was calm.
"Nothing we couldn't handle, Babs." "I'm coming up on the last turn here," Alex said.
"There's a carbon dioxide scrubber intake," Clarissa said. "Don't get caught in the draft. I'm accessing it now." Katria started whistling between her teeth, a tuneless sound that her mic didn't pick up. They reached an access panel with caution placards in a dozen languages and half the colors of the rainbow. Caution, high pressure system. Katria plucked a knife from her boot and pried the panel open as casually as if she did it every day. "Make sure no one's coming," she said.
"You got it,"
Amos replied, sailing on a little farther down the corridor and slipping to the center of the narrow space so that anyone coming the other way would have a hard time getting past him and his massive wrench. Katria pulled the bomb off her back and popped the case open. The workings inside didn't look like much. A cone of carbon silicate lace, the same as a ship's plating. A hand terminal. A pair of standard wires. It didn't look like enough to do much damage. Certainly not enough to blow out the side of the station. But of course it wasn't. That was all coming from the pressure tanks on the other side of the bulkhead. This was just the pin that popped that balloon. "Okay," Clarissa said. "You're good to go."
"Heading through," Alex said. "And we're past. The vent for the server room should be just ahead. Looks a little higher grade than I was expecting."
"Do we have a problem?" Bobby asked. He could hear the tension in her voice. The electrical technician he'd bumped into intruded into his memory, and with it the faint and compromised hope that maybe it would all go wrong and they'd have to abort the mission.
"I think we'll be fine," Alex said. "My little pixies here are armed for bear, but I'm pulling five of them back around the corner here so they don't get mussed up when the vent goes."
Katria closed the case, set it in behind the access panel, squinted at it, shifted it 15 degrees.
What was it like, Holden wondered, being able to picture blast cones in your mind? What kind of life did you have to lead to have that come naturally?
Katria rubbed her throat, and when she spoke, her voice had doubled, coming from the air they were breathing and through the earpiece. The reverb gave her words a weight.
We're done here. We'll see you in the place.
Meaning the shelter. Where, when Naomi and Bobby joined them, they could trigger the blast and wipe out the evidence.
Hey, Katria called down the corridor. You coming?
Amos floated back toward them as Katria slid the panel back into place and slipped her knife back into her boot. They were skimming along through the air together, when it all fell apart.
Alex said, I think we've got a problem here.
What's up, Alex? Bobby asked.
Well, I got my little pixie looking through this vent. Got eyes on both of these Laconian fellas, and one of them's got his hand on something that sure looks like a dead man's switch.
That's not protocol, Bobby said.
It ain't Martian protocol, Alex agreed, but I'm pretty certain that's what I'm seeing here. If I move forward with this, I won't even have the door open before the Laconian fellas know about it. They're going to be ass deep in alligators pretty damn quick.
We knew we were going to have to move fast, Bobby said. This just means we move faster.
It means more than that, Clarissa said. It means they'll log the alarm. The whole point of blowing out the pressure tanks was so they wouldn't know we'd compromised them. If the secure room shows an alert right before the explosion, they'll know what we did. They'll change all the procedures. The data we recover won't be worth anything.
The silence lasted one long breath, then another. Holden felt something in his chest loosen. It was almost like relief, and almost like dread, too. He knew what had to happen before anyone else did.
All right, Bobby said, and Holden could see her clenched jaw as clearly as if she were there with him.
Let me think.
You'll be fine, Holden said. Just wait until the 10th alarm goes off.
The 10th what?
Alex said. But Holden plucked out his earpiece and the mic and tossed them to Amos. The big man caught them in one wide hand.
You going somewhere, Cap?
Yeah, Holden said. Can I borrow that wrench?
Amos pushed it gently out to him. It was massive enough that Holden had to readjust his grip on the handhold to stop it.
Am I getting that back? Amos asked.
Maybe. You get Katri to the shelter. Everything goes forward just like we planned.
Amos's face went still as a mask for a moment, and then he smiled his empty smile.
You got it.
Holden squared himself on the wall's footholds and launched down the corridor. In an instant, Amos and Katria were behind him.
It'll be okay, he told himself. But he didn't dig into why that might be true. He was pretty sure it wouldn't hold up.
It only took about 20 seconds to find a panel with a manual fire alarm. He flipped the case open, pulled the switch down, and a klaxon started screaming. One. In the next corridor, he picked a thin copper pipe, set the wrench around it, and pulled until it popped. Green fluid that stank like vinegar and acetate spewed out into the hall. Somewhere, the system would register the pressure drop and raise a flag. That was two. He heard voices shouting from the main deck. They weren't raised in panic. Not yet. More like they were trying to be heard over the alarm. He passed a radiation alarm and tripped that too, three, then headed toward the voices. Naomi would understand, even if the others didn't. She knew him well enough to follow his mind without so much as a question. There were two ways to hide something. Either put it where no one could see it, or leave it in plain sight with 1,000 others just like it. If the alarm went off in the secure room, That would mean one thing. If a bunch of alarms went off all through the engineering and dock levels, and it was only one, maybe the guards had panicked. It would just be more noise in the chaos. Unremarkable. In the wide space leading to the transfer hub, half a dozen people were clinging to a wall, each of them talking over the others. He recognized the electrical tech they'd passed going in.
"Hey," he shouted, waving his wrench. "Can't you people hear? Get to the shelters!"
It was enough to start them moving. He picked another corridor at random and launched himself down it. He broke three electrical conduits, tripped another fire alarm and another radiation. If he could make his way down closer to the reactors, there'd be more he could break, but there would also be guards there. The wrench was unwieldy and massive enough that cracking the conduits and pipes open was starting to leave his shoulders and palms aching. He ducked into an access crawl and pulled two power exchangers out of the wall. That had to be good for at least one alert. He floated out into another hallway. The engineering deck was drowned in a cacophony of blaring alarms. He pulled himself toward a ladder. When the station was under thrust, it would lead down toward the drive cones. It took the Laconians about 2 minutes to find him, but it felt like longer. Holden was trying to fit the wrench behind a support strut when two Marines in power armor came around the corner, their suits clicking as the actuators fired. Holden started to raise his hands, but the first one slammed into him before he had the chance. The impact knocked a few seconds off his awareness. The next thing he was sure of, there was a barrel pressed just above his left eye, and his ribs hurt badly when he tried to breathe.
"You just fucked up, old man," the guard growled.
Holden blinked.
"I surrender," he said. Breathing really hurt. There were bones broken. He was sure of it. "You don't have that option," the guard said.
Holden realized his life was now based on whether a Laconian Marine, who looked like he was maybe in his early 20s, had the self-control not to shoot his brain pan empty out of anger and excitement. Holden nodded.
"I understand, sir," he said,
and hoped that submission and respect would be enough to keep that one critical neuron from firing.
"I am not resisting. You got me. I'm no threat."
"CJ," the other Marine said. The one with the gun snarled, pulled back a few centimeters, and hit Holden along the side of his face hard enough to split the skin. Bright red globes of blood flew in a cloud and painted the pale anti-spalling cloth of the hallway. The pain was dull at first, and then bright.
"You are an ungrateful piece of shit," the Marine, CJ, apparently said. "If we were someplace civilized, your sad ass would be in the pens."
"What are the pens?" Holden asked, and the guard hit him again, hard against his right ear. He had the impression that CJ enjoyed this kind of thing. Holden wasn't frightened so much as resigned. He'd known that he'd be trading his freedom for the chance that Bobby's plan would work, and for the electrical tech's life. He was past the good part of his plan now, and the bad part might last a very long time, or a very short one. Either way, probably the rest of his life. CJ hauled him out into the free air where there was nothing for Holden to grab onto. A drop of his blood smeared the Laconian's faceplate.
"What the fuck do you have to say for yourself now, asshole?" CJ said, shaking him just enough to make his teeth rattle.
Holden took a deep, painful breath.
"We should probably get to an emergency shelter," he said.
Chapter 33. Bobby.
10th what? Alex said.
His voice was reedy and distant. Not all of that was because of the tiny speaker it was coming out of. Alex understood what Holden was doing just as much as she did. One alarm was significant. One alarm out of a dozen meant less. Holden was giving them cover, and Alex was asking Bobby to say that Holden hadn't just decided to sacrifice himself to keep the mission on track. Her mouth was dry. "You heard him," she replied, keeping her tone all business. "As soon as that 10th alarm goes off, blow the vent, take out the guards, and get us into the room."
"Am I getting that back?" Amos asked, but not to them.
Naomi was staring at her, wide-eyed. She was on the radio, too. She knew what was happening, but she tightened her grip on her tools and pressed her lips together, then gave Bobby a nod. "Good to go." The Rosie's former XO would finish her mission. Then she'd worry about Holden afterward. They both would. The sound of the alarms had started close to them and grew more distant as new sirens joined the cacophony. Holden was moving away from them, which was good considering what was about to happen.
"Chief," Alex said, "that was 10.
Bobby took one last look at her surroundings. She and Naomi floated alone in the narrow corridor. The door to the computer room was 5 meters away, and she had her improvised battering ram in one hand. As it always did in the calm seconds before a mission began, her mind ran through the checklist of things that were about to happen. Nothing popped up as a red flag, so she said, "Go, go, go!" For 3 long breaths, nothing happened. There was a distant thump, like a firecracker going off inside a locker. The first drone just blew itself up to take out the venting cover. This was followed by a shout of surprise. Bobby could picture the 2 men in the room looking up in shock as the vent turned into shrapnel behind them, and 5 tiny drones flew into the room. Then 2 more bangs, close together, like firing a double tap with a pistol. This time louder and closer. 2 more drones going off to take out the guards. The alarm in the room started screeching as the man with his hand on the dead man switch went down, but now, instead of drawing every guard in the area, it was just 1 of over a dozen alarms going off, and new ones coming up every few seconds. Holden had been busy. "I'm getting smoke in the vents," Clarissa said. "I'm turning up the recyclers." The last explosion was the loudest yet, right on the other side of the door. The last 3 drones clustering around the latch and detonating. Alex said,
"My guys are done. Me and my team are cleaning up the logs and shutting down."
Bobby planted her feet on the corridor wall and launched toward the door. The heavy length of ceramic-filled pipe she was using as a ram was gripped in both hands, and she slammed it into the door just above the latch. The door exploded open so violently that it bounced off the bulkhead and swung back hard enough to clip her knee as she flew by. It hurt, but not enough to think about. She had a split second to clock the room. Workstation and 2 dead men with blood soaking their suits floating next to it, server rack bolted to the deck in the center of the compartment, plain metal walls. She slammed into the server rack and bounced off into an empty corner of the room.
"Ouch, fuck."
"What's that, chief?"
Alex asked.
"Nothing. Just went 100 kph when 20 would have done," Bobby replied.
"We're good, Naomi. Do your thing."
Naomi's lean form slid through the opening with belter grace, tapped 1 foot against the bulkhead, and came to a perfect stop next to the server rack. Watching her slide through the air like a fish in water made Bobby feel overlarge and clumsy.
"I'll be in the hall watching for gawkers," she said.
"Mm-hmm,"
Naomi replied, already ignoring her. She was pulling panels off the server rack, and a variety of gear floated in the space around her like a high-tech cloud. Before she left, Bobby pushed over to the 2 Laconian guards and checked their pulse. Up close, it was hardly necessary. Both men had massive head injuries, and bits of bone, blood, and drone parts floated around them. It was a shitty way for a soldier to die, ambushed like that, and Bobby pushed down the feeling of guilt and regret. It was war. Right now, her brothers and sisters in the Martian fleet were fighting and dying in the Sol system in that same war, and a lot more blood was being spilled on their side than on the Laconian one so far. Still, as a person who'd stood a watch in enemy territory, the sightless eyes of the two dead men made her scalp crawl, the way she'd always imagined it would when a sniper had you in their sights for the kill shot. "Your turn now," she told the dead man. "My turn later." She pushed out into the corridor to keep watch. The shrill electronic screech of alarms echoed down the hall and all around her. So far, no one had come to check on the computer room alarm. Why would they? Holden had made sure that the only important alarm was drowned out. She had to hand it to him. As an improvised element of the plan, it was a pretty good idea. Probably something they should have included, just in case. Next time, she thought, knowing there would never be a next time. "Got it," Naomi said from behind her. Bobby nearly elbowed her in the face before her brain could override the startle response. "Great," she said instead. "Let's get to the shelter before Katria gets itchy and blows us all to hell for the fun of it." "Jim won't be there," Naomi said. Amos and Katria were floating in the cramped space of their chosen radiation shelter. It was nothing more than a 4-meter length of hallway with heavy pressure doors at both ends. Netting hung on both walls with rebreathers, first aid kits, emergency vac suits. Bobby had stowed a gear bag with the less standard equipment. As soon as she and Naomi climbed in through the one open door, Katria slapped her hand to the panel and it slammed shut. "What the fuck?" Amos said, rounding on her. "We need that closed when the bomb goes off," Katria replied, pulling the detonator out of her pack. "You know, to live." "Nothing happens without my direct order," Bobby said to her and put a restraining hand on Amos's chest. He reacted by mag-booting himself to the deck, so she kicked on her own boots and clamped them to the bulkhead to keep her leverage. "Babs," Amos said, "I'm going to go get Cap, and it'd be nice if you held off on the boom till I'm done." Bobby waited for Naomi to voice her agreement, then Katria to argue against it, and for their tiny shelter to turn into shouting and chaos. But to her surprise, everyone just looked at her. It was an interesting fact of her brief captaincy that the only time anyone seemed to want her to make a decision was when it was one she didn't want to make. Amos was staring at her, his expression as blank as always. But he held his fists with the ease of long use, and Bobby knew how fast the old man was in a fight. With his feet clamped to the deck for leverage, he'd be tough to restrain if he decided to start swinging. "Our window is closing," Bobby said, raising her hands, making it about the logic of her words instead of a threat. "At some point, someone checks that alarm and finds two dead guys. We don't have time for a rescue." "She's right. So let me blow this fucker and get on with it," Katria added. Bobby winced at the cold disregard in her words, but didn't take her eyes off Amos. Naomi still hadn't weighed in, but Amos's eyes kept cutting to her, waiting for the go sign. If Naomi said, "Yes, go get him," Bobby knew the only way they'd keep Amos in the room was to physically restrain him. Bobby couldn't see what Naomi was doing behind her back, but whatever it was, Amos wasn't getting the signal he wanted because he didn't make a move. "Those alarms were moving away from us fast," Bobby said, still only looking at Amos. "Holden knew the schedule. Either he's made his way to a shelter or he's told whoever has him now to get to one." "You don't know that," Naomi finally said. "No, I don't. But I hope. And right now, that's what I've got. Because we have to blow that bomb now, or this whole operation fails, and we still don't get Holden back.
Yeah, so let's get on with it, Katria said.
Stop fucking helping me, lady,
Bobby snarled at her without turning around. Naomi spoke, and her voice was as calm as it was empty. Bobby's right. This can't all be for nothing. Amos flicked his eyes to Naomi, then locked on Bobby. His face had the same meaningless half-grin it always wore, but his shoulders were tense, and his fists were white-knuckled. A flush of blood darkened his neck. Bobby had never seen him like this before, and she didn't like it now. Not that it changed anything.
Katria, get ready to blow on my signal, Bobby said. Let's get into these emergency suits for evac immediately after. You've got 1 minute to dress.
Bobby heard the Velcro ripping sounds of vac suits being pulled off the walls and hastily donned. Amos wasn't moving.
Put your suit on, big man, Bobby said.
You're really gonna blow it,
Amos replied. He didn't sound surprised, or like he was issuing a challenge. He didn't sound like anything. Bobby involuntarily braced for violence.
Yes, she said.
Without changing his expression, Amos squared up on her, hands at his sides.
I guess you really want that captain's chair back, huh, Babs?
Before she knew she was doing it, Bobby had already grabbed his collar and yanked him up hard enough to pull his mag boots off the floor, then slammed him against the bulkhead.
If we had more time, she hissed at him through her teeth, you and I would be dancing right now.
Amos smiled at her.
I got time.
Katria, blow it, Bobby said.
And the world ended. When Katria's charge went off, it demolished the control panel and ripped a 17-centimeter hole in the oxygen storage tank. Bobby didn't know the exact size of the tank, but she had a vague memory that liquid oxygen compressed down to about 1,100 kilograms per cubic meter, and now all of it was trying to become a gas again, all at once. The initial blast of expanding gas was deafening. The shock wave ripped apart bulkheads and piping. All the liquid oxygen in those pipes joined the explosion as additional expanding gas. From inside the relative safety of their reinforced emergency compartment, it sounded like someone had set off a tactical nuke in the next room. And then, as was inevitable, something oxidized fast enough to produce a flame, and the initial blast of air became fire. The entire emergency shelter shuddered, then canted over onto its side. The reinforced and blast-hardened bulkheads didn't break, but the mounts holding the compartment to the deck were sheared off by the force of the blast. It took seconds that lasted for hours. The inner walls and the pressure doors at each end of the compartment got hot enough to start smoking. Bobby shared a look with Amos, then let go of him, and they both scrambled to get into the emergency vacuum suits. When the exterior bulkhead blew out, there wasn't another deafening explosion, but rather a sudden drop in the sound level. The roar was replaced by the hiss of rushing air, then a high whine, then nothing. The seals on their shelter stayed intact, so afterward all they could hear was their own panicked breathing.
Okay, we're getting massive alarms, Clarissa said, her voice the only calm thing in the universe.
The station's going into shutdown. I'm pulling out, too. I'll see you back at the place.
God damn, Naomi said.
Told you, Katria said. My shit always works.
Bobby finished pulling on her vacuum suit and saw Amos was sealing up his own. They traded a look.
We need to get out of here, she said to him, and he nodded his agreement.
Whatever was going to happen between them, it was on hold for now. They'd come back to it, she was certain of that, and it would need to get settled.
If I just killed Holden,
this probably ends with one of us dead. Whatever she'd imagined when she heard the blasts from inside the shelter, the reality was worse. They opened the door to an entire deck that had been dropped in a blender, then spun up in a centrifuge. Bulkhead panels, control stations, equipment, decking, it had all been torn, twisted, burned, and then thrown out against the outer walls at high speed. A long piece of pipe was embedded in a wall, still quivering like an arrow shot into a tree. Something that looked like a metal desk had been slammed into a support beam so hard that the metal had actually fused. And in one corner, a single boot had been pinned to the ceiling and then melted into a stalactite of rubber. She hoped there wasn't a foot in it. They floated silently through the wreckage, looking for their exit. It wasn't hard to find. A hole gaped in the exterior bulkhead of the drum, nearly 5 meters across. The nearly circular rim of it was all bent outward, like the metal wall had been breached by a giant's battering ram. Which, Bobby supposed, it had. Only instead of concrete and steel, it had been oxygen and fire. Outside, she saw the faint twinkle of light on the ejecta as it raced away from the station and toward the curtain of black at the edge of the ring space. "Exactly where I said it would be," Katria cackled. "Damn near half a meter from the exact spot I marked as the weak point. I should charge money for this." "Do you think anyone survived?" Naomi asked. "We kept everyone we could out of the affected area," Bobby replied. "Only should have been Laconians down here." "And anyone who didn't get our fucking memo," Amos added. "Jim would have warned anyone he ran into," Naomi said. "He wouldn't be able to stop himself."
"Yeah, by then it wouldn't matter much," Amos agreed. "No time to track the bomb down before it did its business."
"And fuck any Laconians who are here," Katria said in a tone that sounded like she'd have spit if she weren't wearing a helmet. "I hope they fucking saw it coming." "Cat," Bobby said, "please shut up now." "This is going to work," Naomi said, pointing out the hole toward the docks. "They're going to think that was our target." The gathering storm sat a few dozen meters away. The nose of the ship and its port side flank showed significant hull damage. Debris from the blast had punched holes in the landing clamps and dragged long gouges down its side. A large cluster of objects that looked like a sensor or communication array had nearly been ripped off the side of the ship, floating now at the end of a tether of cables. It was an eerie ship. The angles of it were like something cut from crystal, and the curves felt like something grown more than built. It was like looking at a venomous snake. She had a hard time pulling her eyes away. "Too bad we didn't kill it," Katria said, ignoring Bobby's request.
"Yeah," Bobby agreed. "Too bad."
Amos pulled a magnetic grapple gun out of the gear bag he was carrying and fired a line over to the elevator shaft exterior. They'd need to climb up to a point not far from the maintenance hatch on the outside of the drum she and Clarissa had used earlier. The hard part would be getting the grapple onto the drum, then hanging on while the station tried to hurl them away at a third of a G. After that, it was an easy climb up to their secret entrance back into the station. Up into Medina from the underworld, and mission accomplished. Unless something else went wrong. The only thing worse than losing Holden would be losing him for no damned reason.
"Laconians are going to find this hatch," Amos said. "Shouldn't plan to use it again after this. No way the crews that come to fix that hole are going to miss it."
"Yeah," Bobby agreed. "If we thought the sweeps before were bad, they're about to get 100 times tighter." "Yeah, fuck 'em," Katria snorted. "No," Naomi said. "It'll be worse than that. We stung their pride before.
But today, we hurt them. Hurt them bad. And they're going to try to make it better by hurting us back. Not just us, either. Anyone who they think might be like us. While Amos hooked his grapple line to the edge of the hole so that they could climb up to the elevator housing, Naomi remained staring at the damaged Laconian ship. "We killed a lot of people today," she said. "Some of them just don't know it yet." Chapter 34. Drummer. "The battle will be here," Benedito Laughlin said, indicating a space between the curve of the asteroid belt and the orbit of Mars. The place where physics and geometry calculated that the paths of the Tempest and those of the fleets of the EMC and the Union would cross. There was nothing there now. No port, no city, no outpost of any civilization. Only a hard vacuum wider than worlds, an emptiness of strategic importance. "We're calling it Point Leuctra." "Leuctra?" "The Spartans were decisively defeated there by Thebes," Laughlin said. "I mean, they call their planet Laconia. Psyops thought it might speak to their sense of their own invincibility." They stared at each other a moment. "That's the best we've got? Intimidate them with classical illusions?" floated at the back of her throat. Laughlin shrugged uncomfortably. "All right," Drummer said, because what else was there to be said? It wasn't as though her will was going to change any of the factors involved. The timetable was listed at the side of the display, days and hours as ticks of red and gold. "The Eggheads have a good model of the Tempest," Laughlin went on, swapping out the map of the system for a schematic of the Tempest. The weird, organic shape of it made her feel like she was looking at a detail from an autopsy. "Here is the vertebra, where things went wrong. You can see the malformation." She smiled at the absurdity of the thought. Laughlin smiled back reflexively. "The only hard data we have is where the PDCs and torpedoes came out. But we also got a lot of good heat data from the last engagement." "The death of independence," Drummer said. "The death of the first void city, and everyone who hadn't fled their home." Laughlin looked down. "That, yes, ma'am. The data's given us some idea about the internal structures, too. Enough that we feel confident that we can target the right places on that bastard. Take it out before it reaches Earth." Because that was the point, Drummer thought. That was always the point. Protect Earth and Mars. Keep the inner planets safe and independent, even at the cost of more Belters' lives. And she'd known that. From the moment Avasarala had stepped into her meeting, she'd known. Some part of her expected to feel some kind of outrage, some betrayal, resentment that the wheel of history was still rolling over the backs of her people first. She didn't. There was a term she remembered from her years in the OPA. Sahamaut. She didn't know where the term came from, but it meant something like the pleasure you take in hardship. It was supposed to be a peculiarly Belter emotion, something that the Inners didn't name because they didn't feel it. She looked at the Tempest now, the guesswork lines of her superstructure and drive, the target points along her hull. Drummer wasn't angry at the Inners for using the Union to protect Earth. She wasn't even angry at the Laconians for being another iteration of everything the Inners had been before the Union existed. War and loss, the prospect of the oppressor's boot. There was a nostalgia to it, a bone-deep memory of what it had been to be young. She couldn't help wondering what that girl, riding rockhoppers and taking gigs at Ceres and Iapetus and Tycho, would have thought of the woman she'd become. The leader of her own oppressions. Not much, probably. Laughlin cleared his throat.
Sorry, Drummer said. Didn't sleep well. Vaughn, could you get me some tea?
Yes, ma'am, Vaughn said.
Also, Palace.
Thank you, she said. She didn't mean it.
She'd placed the strategic update with Laughlin on her schedule on purpose. The Tempest's inexorable flight sunward was slated to reach its point nearest to Palace Station within the hour. The evacuation was complete, or as near to complete as it would be. There was always some old rockhopper with a gun and an attitude who'd stayed behind out of spite and rage. It wouldn't help. One of humanity's oldest homes in the belt would be dead before she went to sleep again. Or, if it wasn't, it would be because Admiral Trejo had seen fit to grant his mercy. She was pretty sure that wasn't going to happen. At least she could go into the terrible, predictable tragedy with all the vulnerable points of the Tempest firmly in mind. She had some hope of retribution. There was a certain peace in the impossibility of subterfuge. Sure, there were stealth ships and long-range torpedoes, the cloak and dagger of vanishing into the vastness between worlds. They worked for a ship, here and there, for the small and swift and furtive. But on this scale, the scale of war on the battlefield of the abyss, everyone knew more or less where everyone else was. Their drive plumes and heat signatures announced them. The hard laws of orbital mechanics and time placed every base, every planet, every person predictably in front of their own personal firing squads. Situations like this one, they could see death coming. And it didn't matter. Death still came. "Did you?" Laughlin said. "We can continue this after, if you'd like." Drummer didn't like. She didn't want to see it happen. Didn't want to hope that Palace might survive. But she was the president of the Union, and bearing witness was part of what she was supposed to do. She wondered where Avasarala was, and whether the old lady was going to watch too. "Yes," Drummer said. "That'll be fine." Laughlin nodded, rose from the table and made his way out of the meeting room. Drummer stood, stretched, and switched the display to the tactical services analytics. The image wasn't real. It was a composite of visual telescopy and Palace's internal data cobbled together into a best guess that was 5 minutes old from light delay before it reached her. Without Tycho beside it, Palace looked calm, still. The curves of the base's structures didn't spin against the starscape. Palace was older than that. By the time they'd learned how to spin asteroid stations up, Palace had been in business for more than a generation. It would die without changing. A countdown timer showed the minutes to the Tempest's closest pass, 7 minutes and 33 seconds. The door slid open again, and Vaughn ghosted into the room, a drinking bulb in either hand. The smell of tea wafted to her seconds later. He didn't speak as he reached out to her. The bulb warmed her palm, and the tea was rich and sweet. "Hard day," Vaughn said. It was strange. She didn't like Vaughn or dislike him, but she'd come to rely on him. And now, in this traumatic hour, it was this crag-faced political operative at her side, instead of Saba. The universe was tricky, and its sense of humor came with teeth. "Hard day," Drummer agreed. On the display, the Tempest fell slowly toward the sun. Palace Station would pass on the ship's starboard, and too far away to see with the naked eye. Admiral Trejo would be watching the show on a screen of his own. The death of Palace would be one of the most observed events in history. 5 minutes and 15 seconds. Which meant, in Palace's frame of reference, now. She took another sip of tea, feeling the hot water against her tongue and the roof of her mouth.
Brownian motion making it seem to fizz against the soft flesh of her palate, beat against the individual taste buds.